Welcome to Terror Incognito, now with two different types of ash.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Terror Incognito. This is episode 102, and as always, I'm your host, Palmer, joined by Sam.
What up?
And then we got a spoke in the wheels, a new addition to the trio. Alex is out for a little bit. She's taking her time having a baby.
And her baby is here today.
Is
no,
it?
No, it's not.
No, oh, damn.
No, she's here with us today. Hello.
This is... Oh. Wow, this took a turn.
We replaced Alex with her unborn child.
Everybody, this is Ash. Ash was gracious enough to give us an interview, what, about a year ago, I guess?
Like a year and change, I think.
A little over a year ago. But she's put up with us on and off here and there. Every once in a while giving us support, every once in a while giving us criticisms when we say bad things about movies that she enjoys.
Yeah.
Which actually, you know, runs the gamut of pretty much everybody who listens to the podcast. Ash, tell us a little bit about yourself. Introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Ash. I could sound a lot less anxious there. I'm a writer and a comedian based in Richmond. I mostly write for RVA Magazine, but I kind of do... freelance stuff and do work for Coalition, and any mic that is open, I will tell very terrible jokes.
There you go. Maybe this episode will actually be funny.
Oh, don't give me that much.
I mean, we're still on it, so probably not.
Yeah, probably not that funny. how'd you get started writing for RVA, Meg?
I graduated college and needed to figure out a plan to obtain a job. Okay. That didn't work, so I applied for an internship, and after that, they had just kind of asked me to stay, and I've been there since.
Okay. You enjoying it?
Oh, yeah. That is... Yeah. It's pretty great. my editor sounds very excited about my enthusiasm there. It's really great. I'm very lucky to work with some pretty rad people.
What kind of stuff do you normally write about? Aside from shitty podcasts.
Awesome podcast. At this point now, I just kind of focus mostly on kind of pop culture, any comics or musicians that come into town tends to be where my focus is, or just anything kind of odd or random, like the television.
Mm-hmm.
The weird television thing
we
that happened
about that.
In Henrico.
I heard they arrested the guy. Found him.
Why would they arrest him?
I don't know. I heard so, and I haven't.
That's like a victimless crime, dude.
So this
is
unverified. This is through the grapevine. Somebody was telling me about this at work yesterday or the day before, and I haven't had the time to look it up. But I heard that the guy that did it got arrested. He was not who people thought he was, which was the front man for some old local band that's been around for a long time that I don't remember the name of. Rumor has it that it's some kid whose dad owns like an old electronics repair shop, and they have just like
of course it was
dozens of old fucking TVs just sitting around, and he thought it would be funny if he went and did a prank by dropping them off at people's houses.
Okay.
I have so many questions.
I don't know if this is actually true or not.
This sounds like the making of a supervillain
or a superhero.
Oh, yeah, TV and a television man. That's basically what he was.
Yeah.
He put a TV over his head and was dressed in that, a bodysuit, right?
Yeah, like a TV on his head, and he waved so friendly.
He did. Like, I don't know. I don't know why you'd arrest that kid. He was just another star in the RVA banner of awesomeness. Personally, that's what I think.
Yeah, so this article is from September 3rd, and it says police believe they've identified the guy who did it. With search warrants for his home. Let's see.
This is fantastic podcast.
It is. It is great stuff. Well, I didn't know we were going to be talking about TV, man. And apparently, he could technically be charged with 52 felonies.
What? For what?
But
Trespassing? Although that's not a felony.
I don't know what the felony is. It doesn't say, but they're saying that it's very unlikely they're going to charge him with anything other than, like, paying back however much it costs the county to go and pick up all the TVs.
I guess, like, guardsmen did have to go by and, like, pick up all the... Or was it policemen or something?
I think it was cops rented a U-Haul for the day and went around and picked up all the TVs.
I don't know why, but this is America. It comes popping into my head right now.
You're not wrong.
That's interesting. We don't really follow up with stuff that we talk about on this cast, but I guess this is a rare first time.
Yeah, we're not a true crime podcast. We don't talk about this shit.
So, aside from TV guy, what else have you wrote about recently? I know you've been doing a lot of comics and stuff.
We've been doing a lot with the comics column, and a lot of my time last month was spent working on, with Coalition Theater, we have an annual sketch review for Richmond Pride, so mm-hmm. called Outburst, so that took up a lot of time, and I wrote a blog post for that, but other than that, it's pretty much the month of September, and a lot of the summer I spent working with that, with my friends, trying to put that together, so.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, that sounds fun. We have another white wine, because fall is all about whites.
We do.
As I have declared many times on this podcast.
I mean, you're wrong, but you're also right, because no. I prefer white wines to red, so all time of year is white wine time for me. but saying that it's winter specific is it's wrong.
Yeah,
but well, you're going to stand by your guns.
I will.
100%. Stand by your empty bottles.
100%. The only time to drink red wine is during the heart of summer.
When it's 108 degrees outside.
Exactly. And the warmer, the better on the white wine.
Jesus.
So I'm not happy with this white wine right now.
I mean, I think it's great.
No, I'm just
kidding.
And
it's cold, and it's served properly, and I'm actually drinking it out of a normal size glass.
Yeah, I have my wine glass. It's okay.
I know you do.
It's a glass. I'm just drinking out of it. I don't see what the problem is.
I'm just content with the label, personally.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, Apothic always does really awesome stuff.
So which one is this, Palmer? What are you drinking?
This is the Apothic White. It's the 2017, specifically their winemaker's blend. Because they do have multiple types of whites that the Wegmans near me carries. It's good. It's fruity. It's vibrant. This is definitely not in a steel cask like last week's, because it's not tinny flavored. And, like, there's no tin flavor to it at all.
Okay.
It's definitely a wood cask. I want to say there's peach in there.
Okay.
I want to say there's... Hold on, let me take another sip here.
I'm learning so much about wine tonight.
He's gotten, like, surprisingly good at this. When we first started this segment, he never got anything right. And now he gets, like, somewhere between
50% of the things.
Somewhere between 50 and 75% of the stuff that's actually in there correct.
I've been so educated the last few weeks just listening to the wine portion. Like, I'm ready to go to a vineyard.
I can really only taste the peach and the white grape.
Okay.
I'm not really getting too much of anything else, to be honest.
So this is a California wine that's, according to them, an approachable blend that combines Chardonnay, Riesling, and Moscato to create a luscious, vibrant, as you said, mm-hmm. wine in the bold style of Apothic's others. Intense flavors of peach, pineapple, honey, and vanilla spice make this smooth white blend mm-hmm. unforgettable.
That's interesting. I think the peach overpowers the pineapple a little bit there, but it does linger.
Yeah.
Now that you mention it. The honey should have been obvious.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
This, I think, might be your first wine with honey in it.
Maybe. Yeah, it is kind of like, because it's heavier than most white wines. It's not quite as, like, it's not as
like, light as, like, a straight.
Like Chardonnay or something.
Chardonnay
like that.
Or Pinot or something.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's quite good.
What would you give this score wise
so far? Well, it's cold, so it automatically gets a one. No, I'm just kidding. It's really good. I probably like a 3.75.
Okay.
Out of five so far. I think I've rated most of Apothic stuff around there.
Yeah.
It's a solid wine. I'm enjoying it. Oh yeah. But we've had what, four different Apothic wines on here? This will either be the fourth or the fifth.
Red, Dark, Inferno, and I think this is the fourth
one. Okay, so this is the fourth one. And then there's like three more white wines they had at Wegmans that
and
they do.
Like
so
six more reds. Once upon a time, it was just Apothic Red.
I dig it. I'm glad they're branching out because I have yet to have a bad bottle of wine by them.
Yeah, all their stuff's good.
Although, to be honest, there haven't been too many, aside from a couple ones that I got that were more experimental, that, what's her name, Rebecca recommended, the Portuguese wine. That was like super sweet.
Yeah.
You're awesome, Rebecca, by the way. Your taste for wine is a little sweeter than mine is. Yeah, I think one from like Spain that we did.
I can pass the sweet wine recommendations to my dad. He'll love them.
Yeah, you've mentioned that before.
Yeah.
That your dad.
The closer a wine is to syrup, my dad prefers. It's kind of gross.
Where do you settle on wine?
I'm kind of with the syrup camp. Unless it's like super cold, then my taste kind of take a 180 and I want it like a very heavy red.
Okay. So you like your reds really cold then?
Kind of, yeah.
So do you prefer warm whites?
You're wrong about this.
In our days and our nights.
See? It's not just me, all right? Last week, I literally like was holding the wine bottle like against me, and it was triggering Alex so much. She was like giving me just, if looks could kill. I know it's a cliche to say.
She wanted
really,
to break
honestly,
the bottle into your face.
She really did. She was very triggered by this. It was.
She was also really upset that she still can't drink because that kid still hasn't come out.
Yeah. So she was supposed to have the baby on the 7th. And he just didn't want to come out, so.
Oh, wow.
She went back home. She's just kind of, like, on bed rest, doing her own thing. And,
gotcha.
Yeah, so we'll find out, I guess. She did say it was okay for us to tell everybody when she finally did, so.
Yay.
I'm sure everybody will know as soon as we figure it out, but until then, we're still doing the rotating guests. I think she just needs a bit of a break and has better things to focus on right now.
I will say last week, I almost hit the car in front of me when you said something about like you thought that she was going to have the baby live on the podcast. Because
so
I was driving while I was listening.
We've been hoping that we would be lucky enough to actually see it happen either on the podcast or at some varying event.
I mean, like, I'm going to see it in a month.
But like, well, we wanted her to come see Three from Hell with us.
Oh, right.
And we were hoping that if she did, that it would force her labor to start. And we've just kind of been hoping that random events that she's come to, it would happen because it would be hilarious.
Yeah. And so, yeah, she like, I don't know. She really seemed like she was starting to have like contractions and stuff. We're just like, this is happening.
Yeah. That chair is going to get thrown out.
Yeah. You can have that.
Yeah. Congratulations. You got yourself a new nursery chair.
Indeed. Indeed. You guys ready to jump into some horror headlines for this week?
Yeah. Ooh. Why not?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Headlines.
All right. Kicking things off this week. Some horror box office stuff. Just like always, whenever there's something to cover that relates to the genre's box office numbers, we're going to open up with our headlines. Sorry. We're going to open up our headlines with discussions about it. And since we're talking about genre-related superhero slash comic book films, this one is definitely on the list. Joker has brought in $93.5 million in the U.S. alone, setting a new record for October. Have you seen this, Ash?
Not yet. I thought I was going to get to see it over the weekend, but that didn't happen, so I'm hoping I can do that this weekend. I've heard nothing but really solid stuff.
I'm in the same boat. I'm going to try to see it this weekend.
It was interesting. I can see why it's people are getting upset about it.
Yeah,
I can see it. I don't know that I understand it, but I can see why people are getting upset.
People got to be upset about something.
That's true. People did leave the theater when I saw it.
Really?
Yeah, there were two points where granted, the crowd that I saw it with, I think we went to go to Cine Bistro.
And it's weird because I don't imagine this is the kind of movie that plays well at a bougie place like that.
No, so it was a much older audience for this film than I think it would have been in like a normal movie theater. And, yeah, so there were a couple scenes, that when you guys see it, I'm sure you're going to be like, I bet this is one of the scenes where people got up and left.
Was the theater full when you saw it?
Yes, it was packed. It was a full house. And yeah, so yeah, I think there were 2 points during the movie where people got up and left. And there were a bunch of points in the movie where old people were screaming, oh my God, at the screen. It was good, though. I don't know that it's considering best movie good, but it's good.
So considering the press this movie was getting in the run-up to its release and how it's supposedly irresponsible in this day and age, $93 million seems like a lot of movie considering there are supposedly a lot of people that were pissed off.
Right.
Are people spending $12 to hate watch this movie?
I think so. I think it's also just getting a lot of word of mouth as a result, you know? Like, people are, like, talking about the controversy, and so people are trying to see if it lives up to the controversy.
I think that's fair. The main point I kept reading about was everyone kept saying it's basically Taxi Driver with a clown.
Yes. I did walk out of that, and it was just
Well, because Scorsese was attached as, like, a consultant for this at one point before he left to go do The Irishman.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's why De Niro got involved, I think, initially. Isn't that why he was initially cast in this? Because he was like, oh, Scorsese's in it. I have to be in it now.
Yeah. It's either him or Leonardo DiCaprio. One of them has to be.
One of the two of them.
So you've seen it. Does Joaquin Phoenix kind of live up to the pre-release Oscar buzz and hype that he's been getting?
Absolutely. If he doesn't at least get a Best Actor nod, I don't know, like, what the Academy is doing. He was easily the best. That and the cinematography were the two best things about the film. The cinematography was some of the best cinematography I've seen in a really long time in a movie. Like, very unique camera angles that really captured a lot of the, I guess, ambiguity that comes with mental illness and, like, how you kind of view the world. And it was just very, like, melancholic throughout, communicated with the camera before the soundtrack got involved. And even, like, when you're witnessing this carnage, like, there's just so much sadness that emanates from it the entire film that it's just, it's a very powerful piece of cinematography. So if it doesn't get nods for those two things, at least, I don't know. I don't think I've seen a film that comes close to it this year in those two areas. Script writing, I thought, was a little lacking, but everything else I thought was great.
That's the main thing I've heard about it, is that if nothing else, you need to appreciate the cinematography work that's being done with it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It really is. It's quite good.
I'm just curious to see it visually, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And I've heard similar comments on this script about how it falls flat in certain places.
I just, it builds and it builds and it builds, and I'm just not sure what it was trying to say.
Yeah, like it falls flat because whatever point it's trying to make either doesn't land or it doesn't follow through.
Yeah. I mean, it's very good. I don't think anybody that goes to see it with an open mind that has any sort of, I guess, is conscious of, like, society in this day and age will have a bad time with it.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, 93.5 million. That's pretty good. It's actually a new record for October. It's also brought in an additional $140.5 million overseas, making its global opening $234 million.
That is a lot of money for a standalone comic book character.
Yeah. Well, it's also just interesting. I think it's nice to see that people are craving something that's not like the Marvel Disney formula, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because WB and DC have had such a struggle kind of establishing something for themselves in that genre since, like, Chris Nolan fucked off with the Batman movies, you know, since he, like, put those to rest. And even, like, the third one wasn't really that well received, but, like, I don't, it's just nice to see. I'm a huge DC fan, so, like,
I mean, the third one was pretty well memed.
These comics, huh?
The third Batman was pretty well memed.
That's true. That is true. You're not wrong about that. I mean, to be fair, pretty much every single DC movie since then has been pretty well memed.
I think too, like, it hopefully this is enough for DC to kind of go back and look at this, and like you said, the Christopher Nolan ones, and go, okay, this is really the format we need to just kind of stick with.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's like one of those things, like, I think they tried to do it with what Zack Snyder was doing, and he just isn't a powerful enough scriptwriter to be able to do it. I think that was, like, the big, like, issue. He's got the eye. Like, let him direct.
He just had too many Marthas.
But don't let him write.
Please, too many Marthas.
Yeah.
No, so I've been reading kind of the early reviews from this, and I've seen a similar thread where a lot of people are kind of hoping that DC sticks with this formula.
Yeah.
And doesn't try to, like, match the Marvel universe. Yeah, you necessarily don't
need a new universe.
You take your existing IPs that everybody knows,
mm-hmm.
and you just create these one-off movies that don't really need good. To be tied together and are really good standalone films.
I mean, Wonder Woman was great. Look what happened when they tried to tie it in.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's and honestly, like, I liked Man of Steel, but look what happened when you tried to tie that in.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'm hoping that they do continue in this direction. Like, if you're going to do, like, a Justice League movie, do a Justice League movie. Don't make it like a universe, you know?
And do it in this style.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Justice League film? Like, I would actually willingly see a DC film.
Yeah.
Isn't that just how you end up with The Boys, though? If you do the Justice League in this style?
Yeah, I mean...
think about that.
No, because The Boys is like the anti-heroes, right? The Justice League would be the superheroes. They would be the good guys. It would just be a darker version of it. So, like, they'd be dealing with, like, more high stakes and, like, villains that are actually going
to
kill people.
But they wouldn't be, like, raping people or blowing them to bits by running through them.
Yes.
Okay. Or unless, like, it was an accident.
Trying to breastfeed. Oh, God. So, projections run this, or have this running at $750 million in total, which is mind-boggling. Warner Brothers has had two very successful R-rated outings in a matter of weeks. First It Chapter 2 and now this. So, looks like this one might have a little bit more staying power. Considered projections for It were initially in $700 million, and they have fallen behind. Right now, Ash is just waving her arms frantically. Because she was adamantly against what we had to say about It Chapter 2.
Fervently.
Go ahead and voice your opinions on it.
Well, real quick, let's just... It's made a good amount of money. Chapter 2 is over $200 million domestically,
yep.
and it's almost at $500 million worldwide.
Yes,
which is a lot of money.
It is.
That said,
that's a billion
between these two movies. It's going to be $1.2 billion. Yeah, between these two movies.
Yeah,
which is like a drop in the bucket
that's
for like
fucking crazy
Marvel Disney. But
yeah,
like that's.
But they aren't doing this with R-rated films. They're doing it with PG-13
and
movies,
true.
And it's taken them what to 12 years to get to this point.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So
that said, everybody's well aware of our views, generally speaking, on It Chapter 2.
Mm.
Defend yourself. This is your opportunity.
Go ahead. Defend your movie. Tell us why we're wrong.
Me and my Richie Tozier phone case are happy to do so in the style of Helga Pataki from Hey Arnold.
That's actually a really, really deep cut reference there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Consistently adding to my Richie Tozier Bill Hader shrine, also in my closet. It's fine.
Honestly, that's a legit shrine.
Ain't it, though? I didn't initially like it at all. I think I went into...
The first one or the second one?
Honestly, the first one. Because
you didn't like the first one?
No, I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't going into it expecting to.
Because
I grew up with the Tim Curry one.
Right.
And I read bits and pieces of the book, and it was what it was. I don't even remember how I saw the first one. I think I was on a date or something. And needless to say, I enjoyed the film more than the date. But it's... Andy Muschietti's approach to it is just very visually beautiful, and I like the way he approaches the narrative and it's developed. I feel I agree with the common criticism that Chapter 2 could have been significantly shorter.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they could have gotten to the big bad at the end significantly quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, the development of the characters I really appreciated, especially kind of tying in how Stanley affected all of them as adults.
Yeah.
Okay. I think was really tactful, especially the way Richie kind of goes into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm spoiling this, I'm sorry. Just go to the film and buy it. It's fine. It's worth it. I'll help you.
Spoilers will not kill you, everybody.
It's going to be okay. We have internet.
It's also been out long enough at this point for a sequel that... Fuck you and spoiler warnings.
Yes.
You've had a month and many matinees. It's going
to
be okay.
Exactly. If you haven't gone to see it in theaters yet, you won't be seeing it in theaters. You're just going to wait for the VOD or Blu-ray or something.
Pretty much.
Continue.
But it's... I really like the way they approached it, and especially just the way they developed, like, the adult characters. Just... I just overall really like the narrative and the visual style, and I thought it... It's just so stunning the way it was done. In the way I really wish... that the Tim Curry one could have been approached, because I feel like those characters were unique in their own, and if they had been approached in this way,
mm-hmm.
it would have been very interesting to see if that makes sense at all.
And so I agree with all of that, and I think I would need to go back and listen to when we talked about it, but
right.
I feel like we definitely complimented the cinematography and the storytelling as a whole, but had the same criticisms where it was too long. The individual, like, each person go off and find their totem or whatever it was, parts could have been condensed a bit. But I think the common thing that just kind of killed it for me, and I think you as well, was just the ending as a whole.
Yeah,
so, that's fair.
So defend the power of bullying.
Okay, cool. I think bullying's great. Because it keeps you alive.
All right.
Well, apparently it does.
Yeah, apparently it does.
Unless your name is Eddie Casbrack, then well, you're going to die in front of your lover in the form of Bill Hader.
Yes. Poor guy. Poor guy.
He can't win.
Did you think, cast-wise, I mean, we know you have... an attachment to one in particular.
And I know what you're about to ask. I also myself love Bill Hader. I think he's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
Do you think it could have been cast differently with anybody else?
And still like kind of retain the quality of it or just in
general? Yeah, retain it. Because I think there were a few weak links.
I can definitely agree with that.
Okay.
First of all, Bill Hader, they couldn't have cast anybody else as Richie Tozier.
Yeah, I think he was great.
Especially,
I think we both are in agreement, or all three of us are in agreement, that Bill Hader was probably the best part of the movie.
I think he was, but I still think he was too funny for the role in that movie. I think it was written wrong. I think if they played Bill Hader the way he plays in Barry.
A little more serious.
A little bit more serious and a lot drier.
Mm-hmm.
But still funny. I still think that would have been the right casting. I think it was just written wrong for him.
I can see that argument and also kind of tack on to it. If you've seen Skeleton Twins with him and Kristen Wiig.
Mm-hmm. I have not.
Yeah.
It's really solid. And it's kind
it's really
of...
good.
I think what we're talking about...
Oh, you've seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That kind of role that's kind of the perfect blend of it's funny, but we're also going kind of dark here.
Yeah.
And I think if they approached it that way, along with the way they approached the humor in Barry, that would have been a lot better for the way Bill Hader approaches Richie.
Yeah.
Hmm. I'm going to have to go check out this Skeleton Twins.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, strangely, it was my wife who recommended it to me.
Okay. I don't even think I've heard of it. And I like Kristen Wiig. But yeah, it... Joker. WB rolling in money. Who would have thought?
Good for them.
Big studio like that. Rolling in the money.
You knew you could do it.
Yeah, right.
We believed in you.
It's October, which means it's usually time for spooky foods, and by spooky foods, we mean just stuff dyed black. Cold Stone Creamery has jumped on board for a trend that everybody seemed to be involved with last year, but nobody seems to be doing this year. Remember
BK?
Yeah,
this is the only time I've heard of it this year.
You remember how BK last year was just dyeing everything like black?
Do you remember how I sent you pictures of the Nightmare Whopper that I had?
Yes, yes.
And the only nightmare it gave me was in my stomach.
That's what they meant. All right. They're turning their ice cream pitch black over at Cold Stone, specifically one flavor, their cake batter. It's now called Boo Batter, a pitch black version of their classic.
I get it, but that's an awful name.
It doesn't sound right.
It really doesn't.
It looks good, though.
So this is what I'm doing this weekend.
Yeah, going to Cold Stone?
Yeah.
I think I'm with you, bro. This is being used as the basis for a brand new October only treat called Trick or Treat Creation. This features the Boo Batter ice cream, along with Kit Kat pieces, M&Ms, and huge chunks of Halloween Oreos, all served in an orange or black ice cream cone. Sounds fun.
Strangely enough, I'm not freaked out by the black ice cream. I'm weirdly freaked out by the black ice cream cone.
Really?
Yeah. Like the pictures I saw of it, it's weird looking.
I think the orange one looks weirder.
My issue is if it's black ice cream, I'd want it to be a chocolate base. Because my brain's not registering that it's supposed to be cake batter and like a more vanilla
right?
kind of flavor.
That makes a lot of sense. I bet that's going to fuck with a lot of people.
I'm going to eat it.
Now it's going to fuck with me.
I don't know. I think it looks awesome. I'm excited. I say this about every one of these things. Like,
it also has Kit Kats.
Great. I'm gonna go try it. We'll see how it goes.
It also has Kit Kats, M&Ms, and Halloween Oreos in it. Yeah. So I don't really fucking care what color it is.
That's true. I have been really just going crazy on Halloween Oreos lately. I am convinced that they taste better than regular Oreos.
I think all of the seasonal Oreos taste better, even though they're exactly the same.
It's just a different color.
Yeah.
I feel that way about seasonal Reese's. Like, the different shape, it just tastes better.
The Easter eggs and Christmas trees are significantly better than the regular Reese's.
Even the pumpkins. Like,
that's true, yeah. I think it's the chocolate to peanut butter ratio is different.
That makes sense.
At least that's how I've convinced myself to spend the money. Although, like, every year after Easter is over, right, they always have, like, the Easter eggs, the Reese's eggs, like, on sale for, like, a third of the price. I just like stock up, but they still only managed to last me like 3 days. I just eat like 40 Reese's a day.
We've all been there. We'll be there again.
Yep. Every year it's just adding to my diabetes. But yeah, it's been kind of a bummer that we're not seeing more Halloween confections. Well, I feel like we got tons more last year. So hopefully there will be more announced as we get later into the month. Stephen King's got a new book on the horizon. This time it's a collection of novellas. His upcoming collection titled If It Bleeds will be arriving just in time for summer next year. Entertainment Weekly shared a cover art, which features a black cat with a snake nose and promises to contain four stories titled Mr. Harrigan's Phone, The Life of Chuck, Rat, and the title story, If It Bleeds. The collection's Amazon description states that novella is a form that King has returned to over and over again in the course of his amazing career, and many have been made into iconic films, including The Body, which ended up being Stand By Me, Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption, which I'm sure you guys can piece that one together, like Four Past Midnight, Different Seasons, and most recently Full Dark, No Stars. If It Bleeds is a uniquely satisfying collection of longer short fiction by an incomparably gifted writer. It's due out May 5th, 2020. And I recently read it, actually, a collection of his short stories called The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. And unlike his novels, he seems to be able to end those a lot better.
Right.
As of late. I don't know. I know you're a big Stephen King fan, but have you read The Outsider yet?
Not that. I've read like some of his other like kind of short story scattered, and that's been a pretty common thought I've had is the short story, it usually ends better, but the longer ones, which is probably why they made the joke in it chapter two,
yeah,
that he can't write a solid ending. But
right.
I think it's probably because he has shorter time to make everything work.
Yeah.
Just fuck it. Throw it together.
Yeah. Yeah. I read through Bizarre Bad Dreams and I was just like, yeah, he's ending every one of these the right way.
Right.
Figure out how to do that with one of your longer books. Cause he's becoming one of those authors that like, I really enjoy the ride. And then I start to get close to the ending and I'm like, oh God.
So, okay. I knew we had talked about this before. You were not there when we talked about it. It was when Alex and I did the Human Centipede episode.
Right.
You finished The Outsider, right?
Mm-hmm.
How was the ending of that one?
Mediocre.
Okay, because I know Holly Gibney is supposed to, like, one of the stories in this book is supposed to have her as the main character.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, The Outsider and Under the Dome are the two that really kind of immediately come to my mind when I think about books that he's really struggled with towards the end. Especially Under the Dome.
It made me so sad.
Huh?
Made me so sad.
Oh, the ending?
I just threw it across the room.
Yeah, I was just like, what is this?
Like, what the fuck?
This was such a good book. And then you just, this is how it turned out. Anyways, I really enjoy the story getting there. It's what I really what I need to do is just learn to read 75% of every book that I buy from him.
Flag the last quarter, like, and we're done.
So this week's side stories on Last Pod, they were talking about It Chapter 2, and I think what they say about the movies applies to the books as well.
Mm-hmm.
Leave either the movie or put the book down when there's about 10% left, yep. And you got yourself a really great story.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't understand how he can be such a great writer. Like, in terms of, like, character development stuff, like, I think he's one of the best modern writers.
Oh, without
doubt. Out there. Like, it's just, he has these great ideas and just can't figure out how to end them properly. But this, I mean, hopefully with the novella format, he'll be able to do so. I'm actually really looking forward to checking this out. Because Bizarre Bad Dreams was actually, I want to say, like, 70% of the short stories in there were really good. If you haven't read it, if either of you guys haven't read it, I'll loan it to you. A fun read, quick read, considering how thick it is, because it's just like you finish one short story and you're just like, I got time for one more. It just keeps you reading for a little bit. Next up, the Anonia Club finally has a new teaser. Tom Six, director of The Human Centipede, is no stranger to pushing buttons. Looks like the Anonia Club, a film we literally have not discussed in about a year, seems to be continuing along those lines.
Sorry.
Did you watch the trailer for this?
I got as far as he was the director of Human Centipede and went, I'm done.
I'm sorry. You said pushing buttons and the first thing that popped into my head was when the woman walked into the bathroom stall to masturbate.
Yeah. Yeah. For those that don't remember, The Anonia Club is supposedly a film about
Schadenfreude. Is it Anonia or Onania?
Onania. I don't know. Anonia. Onania.
One of those two.
One of those two. Narnia.
Chronicles of Anonia.
The Schadenfreude Club.
Yeah, it's about Schadenfreude, which is essentially taking pleasure in others' misery. This seems to be exploring the idea of what happens when the elite get to enjoy the misery of others in quite extreme circumstances. Six claims that it's social commentary on the ever-growing political correctness of the privileged Western world and the hypocrisy of that.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. He claims that it's part Sex in the City on evil steroids and part pure pitch black comedy.
The fucking tagline for this movie made me want to punch my computer and throw it in the trash. Come and see.
Yeah.
See and come.
Yeah.
Are we sure that he wasn't masturbating while he wrote the
I'm pretty sure he's been masturbating since he first started writing this script and hasn't stopped since.
Yeah. I just don't see it, honestly. I'll watch it because it's Tom Six and his work always generates controversy.
I need to know how fucked up this movie's going to be because the trailer.
I don't
think
it's going to be that fucked up. I think it's going to try to shock you, and it's just not going to end up being that shocking.
But that's the thing. Like when we first talked about this last year, like
it was just a group of women masturbating to 9/11 footage.
Yeah, and that was the teaser, and the trailer was pretty much just a longer version of that. Like there was one woman who. A friend of hers she had met for lunch was telling her that her husband or boyfriend or somebody had just died, and she excused herself to go masturbate in the bathroom.
That's my reaction to everything. I don't see what the problem is.
Well, who hasn't been there?
Yeah. I mean, what else are you gonna do?
Right.
There's, you know, the women all masturbating to the 9/11 footage showing up in this trailer again, and it's just that. Yeah. Like, how is this a movie?
I don't know. I
there's gotta be more to this than what's in the trailer.
I really want to be in the room when this was pitched.
Oh, I don't think it was pitched. He's got his own production company. He probably was just like, I'm gonna do this.
Even better. Well, then I wish I was there when he had cereal and went, you know what we're going to do.
While he's masturbating into his cereal.
God, I'm brilliant.
I already think he's a hack. I've voiced that multiple times. This is definitely not looking like it's going to change my opinion on that. It's definitely the most shoddily produced thing I think I've seen him do. Probably because it doesn't have the backing of IFC Midnight behind it. It seems, I think this is the first one his own production company is doing.
Yeah, it sounds right.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's more than an excuse to show women masturbating. Who knows? Maybe I'll be wrong. But this went from having me at least peaked to gosh, just not being interested really that much in this whatsoever. I could have probably inserted like a flaccid joke there, really let it loose, but
missed opportunity.
Yeah. Oh well. Maybe next time, guys. Maybe next time. Bloody Disgusting has also debuted a new trailer for the upcoming Netflix film Eli. This movie looks interesting.
Yeah,
it's the boy in the bubble. If it was spooky. Spoopy boy. The producer of Haunting on Hill House and Gerald's Game is teaming up with a director named Claren Foy, who did Sinister 2, to churn out another spooky-looking film for dear old Netflix. And this one is just around the corner, releasing October 18th. Synopsis is as follows. After checking into a clean house to treat his autoimmune disorder, Eli, aged 11, begins to believe that the house is haunted. Unable to leave, Eli soon suspects that the house and the doctor who runs it are more sinister than they appear. So the catch is that they seem to be pursuing Eli, and he can't just leave. So, like, no matter what, he's stuck here. Because if he goes into the outside world, he dead.
But if he stays, he's dead.
Either way, he dead.
Good luck, buddy.
We'll see how that turns out for him.
Catch up one next Friday.
Yeah, it does look good. It sounds stupid when I'm talking about it right now, but the trailer looked fun.
I'm naturally skeptical because it's a Netflix original.
Yeah.
Aww.
Ever since Tao, he's just been.
Oh well, that's fair.
Really down on Netflix films.
Do I need to remind you of Open House?
Oh yeah, that's a thing too. I forgot about that one's buried deep in the subconscious. What a terrible movie. I don't know. We'll see what it looks like. The trailer looked good, featuring about 2.5 minutes of jump scares, intriguing plot line, and the constant idea of whether or not this is actually happening to Eli. I don't know. Could be fun. We'll link the trailer in the podcast description as always. But that wraps it up for this week's horror headlines. Short and sweet, both literally and figuratively. Sam?
Yes.
What's slaying?
A few things.
Ready to do it now?
Yeah.
Let's go.
All right, so just a few movies this week. Everything's online. You don't even have to leave your comfy, comfy couch or put on those uncomfortable tight pants.
Oh, this is the best day.
Right? Kicking it off on the 11th on VOD, we've got Mary.
Oh, is it about a nun?
It is not about a nun. I know.
So disappointed.
Your heart is already broken. Gary Oldman plays a struggling blue-collar captain named David who's looking to make a better life for him and his family. Strangely drawn to an abandoned ship that is up for auction, he impulsively buys the boat, believing it will be his family's ticket to happiness and prosperity. But soon, after they embark on their maiden journey, strange and frightening events begin to terrorize David and the family, causing them to turn on one another and doubt their own sanity.
Big oof.
With tensions high, the ship drifts off course and it becomes horrifyingly clear that they are being lured to an even greater evil out at sea. Trailer looks like a horror movie on a boat.
What a ringing endorsement.
There are some cool shots in the trailer that show like how claustrophobic it is on the boat and also just like the scale of like the loneliness of being on a boat out in the middle of the ocean.
Is this the lighthouse on a boat?
I think it might be.
Okay.
But it's not black and white.
Damn it.
Next up, this one we've talked about before a while back, and I'm super excited. This comes out on the 11th on Hulu from Neon. Little Monsters.
Okay.
This follows Dave, played by Alexander England, a washed-up musician who volunteers to chaperone his nephew's kindergarten class field trip. After taking a shine to the plucky schoolteacher, Miss Caroline, who's played by Lupita Nyong'o. Dave's intentions are complicated by the presence of the world's most famous kids show personality and the competition for Miss Caroline's affections, Teddy McGiggle, played by Josh Gad. You don't have to muffle your laughter.
What a
here.
Great name.
It gets pretty high-pitched.
One thing none of them bargained for, however, is a sudden zombie outbreak from which Dave and Miss Caroline must protect the children.
Hell yes.
This has been lovingly described as Zombieland meets Kindergarten Cop.
Okay.
And that's all you got to say to get me to watch this movie.
Okay. All right.
Do you not remember this?
I don't.
I do.
The very colorful trailer.
Yes.
So I'm super excited about this. I'm gonna have my Halloween ice cream and watch that this weekend. Okay. And finally, this week we have a sequel. Along Came the Devil 2 on VOD on the 11th. After receiving an unsettling voicemail, Jordan returns home looking for answers, only to find her estranged father and even more questions. A demonic force has attached itself to the town, and no one is safe. And the only one who seems to know anything is the small town's reverend. Get you closer to nuns.
Sort of.
Boy, it's nuns. A
step in the right direction. Buns.
Have either one of you seen Along Came the Devil, the first one?
No.
No?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, that's all we got this week. Those are your three cozy, comfy options.
Was it a Korean film?
You mean, was the first one a Korean film?
Yeah. Maybe it was I Saw the Devil. Maybe that's
I
what
Saw
I'm
the Devil was. Okay. Yeah, Along Came the Devil was not.
Okay. I guess I'm thinking about different things. There's just so many devils.
Along Came the Devil came out last year.
It's very hard to keep devils straight.
Yeah, that was Along Came the Devil came out last year. It was filmed in Atlanta. This one also filmed in Atlanta.
Okay. Well, good for them. Does it look any good?
It looks okay. I imagine it would make more sense had I seen the original.
Oh, okay.
So the trailer kind of left me grasping at straws because I'm not entirely sure what's going on.
Alrighty then. Well, if that's all you got to say about the Now Slang.
Yes, sir.
I guess it's time for the main event.
I believe so.
All right, let's do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's main event.
All right. We can officially say we're moving into superhero territory for the first time ever on this podcast. This week's main event is Darkman. Came out in 1990. It's directed by Sam Raimi. There's a whole bunch of writers on this. Sam Raimi is responsible for the story. Chuck Ferrer for the screenplay. Sam Raimi also for the screenplay. Even Raimi for the screenplay. Daniel Golden and Joshua Golden also responsible for the screenplay. The cast stars Liam Neeson as Peyton Westlake / Darkman.
Liam Neeson's?
Yep, Liam Neeson's. I wonder where society sits on him these days. Francis McDormand as Julie Hastings. Colin Frails, I think is how you
say. I think so.
Is how you say his last name? Louis Strack Jr. Larry Drake as Robert Durant. Nelson Machida as Yakatito. Jesse Lawrence Ferguson as Eddie Black. Rafael Robledo as Rudy Guzman. Dan Hicks as Skip. Ted Raimi as Rick. Dan Bell as Smiley. And Nicholas Worth as Pauly. Good old Pauly. Bruce Campbell has a cameo at the end of the film as well, donning his signature chin as Peyton's last disguise. Darkman was created in response to the repeated unsuccessful attempts by Sam Raimi to secure the rights to direct a superhero film. Joke's on them.
Specifically The Shadow or Batman?
Yes. Yeah. Joke's on them, because when Sony cashed in, that kind of arguably started the whole superhero trend, really kind of brought it to the forefront of things. After the success of The Evil Dead and Tim Burton's Batman, Raimi pursued rights to The Shadow, like Sam said, and a movie adaptation of a popular radio program and a Batman sequel. He failed getting both. As a result, he penned a short story that paid homage to both Universal's silver screen horror films of the 30s and The Elephant Man, and created a character called Darkman. Originally starting off as a 30-page short story, it developed into a 40-page treatment, which, according to Raimi, went from being a simple short to being fleshed out as the story of a man who had lost his face and had to take on other faces, a man who battled criminals using his power. Coupling this with a bit of tragic love story mixed in for good measure, the final result is what appeared on screen. Because of the inspirational source, Universal expressed interest in the script and ended up picking it up, making this Sam Raimi's first major studio film. They slapped Raimi with a $16 million budget, sent him off to the races. The result was a film that went on to score both well with critics and audiences, although not initially. The test screenings actually had this... Universal was getting ready to say that this is the worst film that they had ever made. apparently, all they had to do was change the soundtrack, and audiences were happy with it after that.
Interesting.
I found that to be kind of interesting, too. The things you learn on Wikipedia.
The things you learn just by watching the bonus features of the DVDs.
Yeah. Right. Oh, you have the DVDs.
I think I watched this on HBO. I don't have the Blu-ray DVD for this, but I did find the special features online.
Ah, okay. It garnered, it earned $49 million worldwide and spawned two sequels off a budget of, like I said, only $16 million. So it was considered a success.
Direct-to-video sequels.
Yes, yes. Two direct-to-video sequels.
Which is a very common thread with the movies we're talking about this month.
Yes. Yeah. That is kind of the theme of what we're discussing this month. Darkman 2, The Return of Durant, and Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die, which apparently were released backwards.
Yes.
It was supposed to be Darkman 3 first.
So, Die, Darkman, Die. Where did I write that note down? They came out backwards because they did one of them first. I'm just trying to find it real quick. I don't know where my note... There it is. Die, Darkman, Die was supposed to be the first sequel because Larry Drake wasn't available initially. After they had finished filming and finished post-production, they were probably, 6 to 8 weeks away from releasing it. Larry Drake's schedule cleared up.
Right.
So they held off on this, shot the other one, and then swapped them out.
It's just interesting to me.
Yeah. it's very weird.
Yeah. It also went on to create a whole bunch of comics, books, games, and more. What was it you that were saying that you wanted to go find your NES because you saw that there was a game based on this?
Oh yeah, I need to buy an NES now so I can play this game. Which is apparently I saw a lot of people saying it was weirdly difficult.
Yeah, I mean, have you gone back and played NES games recently? Because they are very hard.
I remember a lot of games of that, NES, SNES, and even some of the early Sega games, strangely, wildly difficult, especially in comparison to modern video games.
The Lion King was one of the hardest games I think I've ever played in my life.
Or Aladdin?
I was about to say, Aladdin's still the only game I haven't beaten.
Really?
The Beavis and Butthead video game was really hard.
I ran through, Aladdin as a kid, so many times I can't even. I didn't have any problem with Aladdin. And I'm really not very good at video games. Sam can attest to this.
It's true. It's pretty true.
That's interesting. But yeah, I couldn't even get past the second level in Lion King. I don't know why.
Yeah, all of those games historically were hard. Outside of Super Mario and Sonic games. Most of the stuff from those consoles was actually really tough.
Yeah, definitely wasn't easy. Those were a different day for gaming. The movie has earned itself a cult status and has been credited with exposing Raimi with worldwide recognition outside of the horror sphere. I mean, obviously, Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 did really well, but
yeah,
this is kind of what brought him to the forefront of people who weren't into horror movies, I guess. It also might have helped set a template for movies mid to late 90s superhero movies that were to come. Judge Dredd and The Crow both immediately come to mind.
Oh, I've got a lot more than that.
Yeah.
I got a whole list of what came out of this one movie.
Yeah, it's something we're going to discuss plenty of later. In the meantime, you guys ready to talk about the synopsis? Let's do this.
Dive on in.
The film opens with an introduction to our villain, Robert Durant, and his cronies Rick, Skip, and Polly as they witness a negotiation go south for Eddie Black, Durant's only crime rival. Skip has a fake leg, which he stores a weapon in. In a sudden turn of events, Black is left without henchmen. What a ridiculous scene.
I think amazing is the word you're looking for?
Just from the opening, 5 minutes, it's got Raimi's signature style of slapstick right into it.
I mean, it is slapstick, but it's also kind of cribbed from the Penguin's machine gun umbrella.
Yeah. But was that really a thing before Burton?
No, it wasn't, but I mean, that was a year before this. So that had just
was
happened.
It? I thought Returns came out in 92.
Was that in Returns?
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. Never mind.
So technically, Burton got that from him.
That's true. We can add that to the list that we'll talk about. I always forget that Penguin was Returns.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Joker was the original Batman.
That's right.
That was, what, 89?
Yeah, that was the year before this.
Yeah. So, Durant lights up a cigar, a reoccurring event for his character, and proceeds to remove Black's fingers one by one as we cut to the opening credits. Dr. Peyton Westflake is he's developing a new type of synthetic skin. And it's, what, for burn victims, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But it can't get past a fatal flaw. Causes the skin to rapidly disintegrate. Honestly, it melts after 99 minutes.
It kind of boils first.
Yeah. It like bubble. It looks like acid, really. It's just right? like being poured on it, and then it just dissolves into a mess.
I was going to go with a Celeste pizza for one.
But
acid works, too.
There you go. There you go. His girlfriend and attorney, Julie Hastings, discovers the Belisarius memorandum. God, it's like they just... Raimi was like, what's the most complicated name we can give this document? Belisarius. Done. It does sound fittingly sinister, though, for something that is really just like money laundering.
It makes it sound way more important than it actually is.
Right? It's an incriminating document that proves developer Lewis Strack Jr. has been bribing members of his zoning commission with payoffs. It also implicates him for working with Durant and laundering money through his crime organization. When she confronts Stack, he confesses immediately, very easily, showing Julia that he plans to... that he plans to design a brand new city, creating a substantial number of new jobs. He warns Julia that mobster Robert Durant also wants the document. It's an interesting setup for the film.
Yes.
You definitely know something's going to go south mm-hmm. as soon as this document's introduced. You just don't realize kind of how south. And you also don't realize how much of a role that coffee ring on that piece of paper is going to play until like three quarters of the way through
this
film.
This was Starbucks' fault. God damn it.
Mess up this. Messed up Game of Thrones.
Yep. Oh, God, I forgot about the Starbucks coffee
cup.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a season 8, you fucking piece of shit.
Daenerys didn't forget.
No. Neither did anybody on our free folk.
Starbucks ruins everything, man.
At Westlake's lab, Westlake and his assistant, Yakutito, they're testing the skin that he's trying to produce. When the lights go out, the synthetic skin is stable after 100 minutes when it's in darkness. Hence
that
the
seems
name,
like a really,
Dark Man.
That's a really arbitrary amount of time, too.
What, 99 minutes or 100 minutes? They're just happy that it hit like 99, like a one.
So
it's very specific.
And it's like, I get like 99 versus 100 sounds good when you're talking about minutes. An hour and a half is 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. So this lasts an hour and 39 minutes.
Yes.
Which is a very arbitrary amount of time.
It really is.
And it's really kind of dumb.
Well, the other thing is, like, there's a couple, like, inconsistencies in this film, right? Like, so, like, if it's exposed to light at all, does it start the,
right?
The hour and 39 minutes?
And does it only start to decay if it's currently under light? Or can you go outside for, like, 30 minutes and then go hide in a dark room for, like, 6 hours and you still have an hour and 9 minutes worth of light exposure?
There's just so many questions.
And also, what kind of light? Like... Low light? Are we okay with, like a black light?
It doesn't really
light?
Seem to make a difference.
Yeah. It seems to be, like, whatever kind of light, right? Because, like, in the lab, they're just using unnatural light. Like, it's all, like, fluorescence and stuff. And then when he's out and about during the day, the UV light does the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just like, what? What about the light is doing it?
Like, why doesn't he just put on a mask and start a new career as a bartender? You never see the sun.
That's true. You could just be a night person, just work
just
the
live
night
at
shift.
Night. Or does the light reflected from the moon also make the mask melt?
That is a good question. One that I don't think we ever get an answer to.
No, we absolutely don't.
There's so many more questions.
Right. Westlake deduces that the skin is photosensitive. But their joy is short-lived. As Durant and his men show up and demand the memorandum, which Westflake knows nothing about. They search for the document and Durant has his men kill Yakutito and beat Westflake, burning his hands and dipping his face in acid. Because they just have a vat of acid. Speaking of acid, just like randomly in the
middle
of this.
Well, it was also like hooked up to the like electric coils that burned his hands.
Yes.
I assume it had something to do with making the material they're using to make these burn skin pieces.
You'd think something like literally born in acid would would end up not dissolving.
It's also the start of the 90s, and that was like an entirely different world.
It was. There were a lot more acid-based films in the early, late 80s, early 90s, you know.
Yeah.
The Joker and Batman just was dipped in like a fucking acid bath. Yeah. Not to mention all the sequels to Aliens that were going on at that time. You know, acid was just a prevalent thing.
The 90s was a super science heavy time. We were obsessed with acid.
Lasers were a big thing.
Lasers. That's true. We were suddenly all hackers as soon as we guessed someone's AOL AIM password correctly.
Yeah.
We were ready to break into the FBI. There was a lot going on.
There was. I mean, it's just the AOL chat rooms. Just, we got somebody's ASL and that was just the end of it. We owned the world from that point on. It was a unique time. A unique time. After finding the document, Durant and his cronies rig the lab to explode, and happens to do so just as Julie arrives.
Having made her decision to marry him.
Yes, she's getting ready to say yes. And the
wonderfully convenient movie timing.
Yeah, and just as she's approaching to walk up and say, I do, the whole building explodes around her. But she walks away just fine.
She doesn't even get knocked down.
Nope.
She's doing great.
She's a real trooper. Honestly, she should be the superhero of this movie. Because I think there's something going on there. She's indestructible, apparently.
Yeah. Her wrists don't break at the end when, like, her arm should get ripped off. But we'll get to that.
Yeah. So, now that the lab has been blown up, you know, Westlake's thrown through the roof. Lands in a river. Nearby. And he's discovered. Becomes John Doe. He's brought to a hospital and subjected to a new radical treatment, which cuts the nerves in his spinal tract.
And spins him in circles.
Yes. And this both stops him from feeling pain, the pain of the burns, which I can imagine was severe, but also sort of drives him insane. It's like a system of give and take.
I have thoughts on this.
What are your thoughts on this? I can't. I don't know where to like start with this.
I'm not. Well, there's a lot to unpack, but it's also not that surprising because Sam Raimi is the one directing it, and I feel like he doesn't know how to just organically have someone, you know, go a certain way. They just have to immediately lose what is left of their fucking mind. In a 10-second clip.
Yep.
Yeah.
It definitely happens.
And he's got like 3 of these 10-second clips of losing his mind, and they're fucking wonderful.
And each one of them just gets worse.
Also, strangely though, didn't the doctor say it was only like 40% of his body that was burned?
Right.
Yeah, that seems.
So it's not his hands, his face.
Like the majority of his face.
Well, not just face, head.
Yeah.
So his head, his hands. Up to, like, his elbows.
Yes.
And
they took my hands.
Like, honestly, and so what else? Maybe both of his arms all the way up to the shoulders and his head.
Yes.
That doesn't seem that bad, considering what happened.
I was about to say,
worse. Honestly, you walked away from this one pretty well. Good job. So it also gives him enhanced strength. And well, this is due to what, an adrenal overload?
There's actually like a strange amount of cases of people that have like no reactions to pain. I don't know the exact name of the condition.
It is actually like a medical. It is a medical condition.
It is a real medical condition. And some of the stories that I've read about these people actually kind of line up with what Raimi was putting together in this.
Yeah.
How, like, I heard this on an episode of House, and it's really bothering me that I don't remember the name.
That's because the only name of anything I can remember from House is Lupus. Well, that's how they start out every treatment.
It's gotta be Lupus. Until that one Lupus, episode where it Lupus is Lupus.
Lupus is like the Scooby-Doo red herring of House, except for that one episode. but no, it is really interesting that Raimi did this and this was kind of the outcome, because a lot of the stories that I've read about these people that can't feel pain go through like a similar sort of psychosis, because they, like, their external reactions just don't exist.
Right.
And they will commonly do things like put their hand on a hot stove and not know it's there and end up like melting the fucking skin off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's actually like more of a burden than it is a blessing from what I understand.
And because of that, it can often lead to all sorts of like mental issues because they don't have those sensory factors and they're constantly worried about doing things. Just an interesting little thing that Raimi kind of put this together. And I don't know how prevalent this was or how reported this condition was back in 1990.
Back at the time. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I'm sure it was known of.
Yeah.
And probably studied to some sort of extent. Because the 90s actually was like the pretty much the starting point for like a lot of like in-depth study for mental illness. Well, not mental illness, but like any sort of like immune disorder or stuff with the body, really, kind of in general. I don't know. As we've said multiple times so far on this podcast, the 90s were an interesting time.
It was a time to be alive.
Yes, it was a time to be alive. Collectively, we experienced it.
There was definitely, if nothing else, a time where I think there was a lot more awareness.
Yeah.
For sure, even if... Well, I'm sure research was done, obviously, but we were starting to like kind of look at more of, okay, maybe we should kind of examine this a lot more.
Right. Believed dead by Julie, Westlake reestablishes his lab in a condemned building and begins the long process of digitization to create a mask of his original face. Westlake uses the time to plot revenge against Durant and his men.
24 days.
Yes.
Or 23 days and change.
And like, what is a madness montage, because he goes through kind of like discovering that he can't use his hands to like
I believe he sang himself a song.
Yes, he did.
And it was "See that dancing freak,
yes,
just $5. See that dancing freak, pay only $5."
Very Sam Raimi.
Also, I'm pretty sure his computer was the same one from The Thing. That like
was it?
Well, I mean, like, reporting how long it's going to take for shit to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very impressed about the fact that it had a massive chunk of shrapnel inside the back of it and it still managed to work. They just don't make things the way they used to these days.
Oh, man. That's stopped when they killed off those Nokia phones.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. I used to play Snake on those things all the fucking time.
Play Snake? You could use it as a brick?
Yeah.
Paperweight?
You could bludgeon somebody with it? You could
lock your keys in your car, break your window with the phone?
Yeah, exactly. Fall into a lake, break your car window with the phone. Bam. Mission accomplished. It's just all sorts of uses. Whatever happened to Nokia? Nokia, if you're still around, write into Tara Incognito. Let us know what's going on.
I'm actually curious what happened to Nokia.
Call from your iPhone.
Yes, call from your iPhone and let us know what you're doing, what you're up to these days, Nokia. Durant, after plotting revenge, manages to kill Durant's henchman, Rick, after forcing him to reveal the identities of other men. This is one of the more bizarre scenes of the film, I think. Just kind of what he puts Rick through. He grabs... This is one, manhole covers don't just fly off like that, but...
Yeah.
They don't?
No. No, I don't think they do. I think they weigh a lot, and that would have crushed his head.
Looney Tunes lied to me.
So do Sam Raimi film. Well, I guess they lied to Sam Raimi too, because he didn't get the memo on that one. So yeah, he manages to get Rick to reveal the identities of other men, and then studies them to subdue them and impersonate them, having just more than enough means to be able to literally create the skin that he wants to be in. I feel like that's a commercial slogan, isn't it?
It should be.
Love the skin you're in. Isn't that a thing?
That is.
What is it?
It's Olay. It is Olay.
Is it Olay?
Yeah.
Love the skin you're in.
Love somebody else's skin you're in.
It should have been the tagline for Darkman.
I was going to argue, like, isn't that, you know, during Buffalo Bill's campaign he had a few years ago?
Yeah. It was for some sort of lotion. So, after he torches him, studies all these people, he starts creating the skin, and his first target. Let's say odd-shaped man with no hair.
I'm trying to say bald people Paul are Paul odd-shaped.
Yes. Oh. Somebody who's slowly losing their hair.
Is that why you're holding on to it so desperately?
I don't want to be odd shaped. Yeah, I don't know. This whole interest. So he studies Polly at a deli.
Yes.
Polly eats the same hot dog with sauerkraut and chips every single time that he goes to this deli.
There's nothing wrong with that.
You can only imagine how bad his breath smells. He manages to sneak into Polly's house, apartment, and put on some of his clothes, puts on his skin, and knocks him out, right?
I believe chloroforms him.
Yeah, correct? Chloroforms him. Keeps him asleep, so Polly has no idea what's going on. He then proceeds to pretend that he is Polly.
Yeah.
Goes to the deli.
Has another hot dog.
Gets served his regular, I think it's more of a brat.
Yeah.
It's a brat with sauerkraut and chips. And gets the suitcase and walks out of there, but his face starts bubbling out. They're like, you okay, Polly? Yeah.
I would have wanted him to grab the chips with the suitcase, though.
Oh, yeah. Just like, I need this plate and the suitcase. Just walks out with it.
Staying on brand here.
Yeah, because it would have been like Paul, you know, he's like, I got to go, you know, and just stuffs his face with a bunch of brat before running off. But yeah, he does this all through kind of like the digitization because he's got that whole device back up and running.
Yeah. All by himself.
It's very impressive.
In what seemed... It seems like a matter of days, but it's a couple of weeks at the very least.
Right.
Just to get everything set up, and then another couple of weeks on top of that to start making shit.
Right. He also starts to kind of like try to pursue Julie. So he develops develops his own face back again, I guess, and creepily shows up at a graveyard. As she's trying to mourn his death out of the blue.
You know, I didn't realize it until you said it, and I know we're going to get into this after we're done with the synopsis, but I think I finally understand why this franchise hasn't been remade.
I don't.
I think I do.
Is it because...
He makes masks to pursue women and stalks them through graveyards.
The pinnacle of romance.
It is. It is. It is. It's eerily similar to Hollow Man with Kevin Bacon.
Just a lot less penis.
Yeah, and a lot less digital dong.
Yeah.
just a very well-rendered Kevin Bacon dick. I almost said Kevin Spacey dick, and that's a whole different type of dick.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Obviously, Julie is very off-put by this interaction and is very understandably freaked out at first, but after some explaining he does one of those quick I was in a coma lies. she seems comforted by the fact that he's back, considering they kind of hug each other in classic 90s style, and all is right with the world with the sunset in the background and everybody's happy.
There was a lot of comas in the 90s.
There were a lot. There's still a lot. It depends on like whether or not you're still watching soap operas.
Yeah, because they happen
like every other week.
Do we blame this on soap operas?
I don't know. I feel like it's a shtick that he... Didn't one of the characters in Spider-Man get like into a coma or something? I don't know. I feel like he revisited a lot of themes in that he presented in this film in like the Spider-Man trilogy that he did.
Yeah,
especially the dance scene. You remember when?
Yes, vividly.
When she's dancing with what's his name, Strack, where he's like, "Oh, I can't make your pain go away, but I hear dancing will make it feel better," and they.
So I'm pretty sure...
I didn't realize we were talking about Crispin Glover.
I'm mostly positive that Spider-Man 3 was just an attempt to remake this movie.
Oh.
I see.
Yeah, there was a lot more slapstick in Spider-Man 3 and a lot more kind of like weird comedic
and weird Raimi decisions that only Raimi would make.
Yes.
Or big Raimi fuck yous.
Yeah.
I think it was more the latter at point in time, considering his relationship with that studio at that point.
Bless his heart.
Well, we got two good movies out of it. I'm just gonna leave it at that. So Westlake, he starts to kind of harbor confusion, creates it amongst all of Durant's henchmen, and just simply by assuming their identities, doing weird things, and on a date at a carnival with Julie, an altercation causes Westlake to lose his temper, revealing to Julie that something is wrong with him.
Pink elephant for my girlfriend, please.
Yes, he flees as his face begins to melt, and she follows him, discovering the discarded mask. So this is an interesting scene, right? One that I don't think would play very well in modern audiences, right? Because this is like,
have you ever won anybody? Like, pink elephant?
The pink elephant isn't the issue here, man.
This whole scene's a hot fucking mess.
It really is. It really is, because it's literally one of those, like, you're getting the classic signs of, like, spousal abuse or, like, something that could eventually turn into that, you mm-hmm. know? Like, from somebody who's, like, losing their temper. Yeah,
flying off the fucking handle because some carny won't give you your pink elephant.
But still, they play him off as the sympathetic character after he just broke a man's hand. Like, whole fucking hand.
He might as well have just ripped it off.
And proceeds to borderline lash out at Julie and then suddenly stops.
Julie, I'm sorry!
Gets a hold of himself and runs off with his skin bubbling into the sunset. It was a much different time.
I felt a lot of things at carnivals. Nothing that happened here is any of those things. In any facet.
It just sounds like you're going to the wrong carnivals. I
don't know. Apparently. Chesterfield Fair has lied to me my whole life.
Right? Yeah, we were just at the Virginia State Fair, and I was just like, I don't remember ever seeing anything remotely resembling this, but hey, here we go. Here we go.
But did you win your wife a pink elephant?
I did not.
That's why you didn't see this.
Me and my wife are content with our fried Oreos and our bacon covered grilled cheeses.
Rightfully so.
Yes.
But what about funnel cake?
No, she did have a funnel cake.
Okay, then we're
good.
She did.
She didn't finish it, but she had a funnel cake.
That's okay. As long as she had it, that's all that matters. Yep.
Yep. She went for it. I went with the fried Oreos.
Also a good choice.
Mm-hmm. I guess.
Were they fried Halloween Oreos?
No. No, they weren't.
You need to start writing some sternly worded letters.
I really do. I really do. Well, the other issue for me in fried Oreos is, like, I always forget that they're soggy.
Yes.
And I don't know why, like, year after year, I get the fried Oreos, and I'm always super excited about the fried Oreos. Then I take a bite of them, and then they're just not crunchy, and that takes away from it for me. You'd think after several years of going to the state fair and getting fried Oreos that I would be aware of this.
Because you only have it once a year.
But, like, it really, it's like, so there's a thing called pregnancy brain, where, like, apparently women totally forget how much it sucks to be pregnant. And it's like it's a natural thing that occurs, so people will have more babies, so they'll have more children. And it makes total sense, but I think that what I get for fried Oreos is literally the fried Oreo equivalent of pregnancy brain. Because every single year I just want
to. You
just
forget how disappointed you are after having it.
Both in myself for continuing to eat them and in the product.
And then time passes and heals all wounds.
And then I go for it again, and yeah.
It's, what if you had them more often? Maybe you'd learn.
Or maybe you would start to forgive them for their general sogginess.
Yeah, maybe I just get used to that.
Yeah. Because they're not crunchy, but they're still delicious.
But, like, when I take a normal Oreo, right, like, all I do is just dunk it in milk and hold it until it's soggy. Yeah, but I'm really disappointed. I'm really disappointed when it's soggy and fried. I don't know why. Just a weirdo.
It sounds like you eat Oreos like normal human beings.
Yes.
But you're upset when someone gives you one that's already done the crunchy to soggy conversion for you.
Yes. Because I want it to be in milk, not in grease.
You say that. Well, I don't think you mean it.
You might be right on that. We'll come back to that topic at another time. Oh, man. All right. Where were we?
We're still at the carnival.
Oh, the carnival. Dear That's right. God. That's
right. We are still at the future site of domestic abuse carnival.
I totally lost my place in my notes.
I think that's how they advertise that carnival.
The domestic abuse carnival.
Future domestic abuse carnival. This time it's not the carny beating up their spouse.
But also love the skin.
Yeah. Just Olay. Just right there on the billboard.
Brought to you by Olay. So I think the Buffalo Bill quote would actually be, I love the skin you're in. I think that's how that works.
But only if you're a great big fat person.
Oh, great big fat person.
Just eats more fried orange. Yeah.
That's what he's throwing down into the pit. At the end of that movie is just the fried Oreos. Every time I watch that movie, though, like my daughter, my mom had a toy poodle that she insisted, insisted on naming Princess. And she loves this movie. She's seen Silence of the Lambs.
Oh.
She knows that this dog was named, and I think subconsciously that's why she wanted to name that dog this. I had to like sit down and explain to her like why she couldn't name a tiny little toy poodle Princess. And she was like, you could, because she had it for like a couple months at this point. And I was like gone at school at this point in time. I came back and I was like, oh, you got a new dog. And it's named Princess. And I looked at her and my eyes got all wide. And I was just like, what are you doing? And we sat down and we had a conversation about it. I was like, do you remember Silence of the Lambs? She's like, yeah, I love that movie. What was the name of the dog? I don't remember. Why is that relevant?
Oh, it's relevant.
Let me explain this to you.
Was this her way of approaching it, like when you meet a very tall man and you name him Tiny to be cute and quirky?
Yeah, I guess so.
Oh.
People will think it's hilarious.
My mom was a character. Also, I'll say that much. So she finds the discarded mask. She calls to Peyton and, she follows him to the lab, right?
Yep.
She calls to him, says she still loves him regardless. He should have just told her the truth and that she would have been happy. You know, I feel like a lot of issues that this movie has could have just been solved with a simple conversation. You know, like, I feel like they were going for the whole, like, Phantom of the Opera type thing with this.
There's a lot of that in here.
And literally all he needed to do was just be like, I'm horribly disfigured. This
but he's
is a
ashamed,
mask
Palmer. He might not be able to feel pain on the outside, but he can on the inside.
It's only amplified by what they did to his spine.
His life is nothing but shame and internal angst and agony.
Yes.
But now follow me on this one.
I'm listening.
Clearly, I'm just kind of going off what you said. Clearly, we've established at this point, Julie is willing to accept a lot of shit in her life.
Yeah.
In an unhealthy way.
Yes.
We've burned down your house. Oh, okay. That's fine. Sure.
I'll find a new place.
There's another one right there.
The power of the power of dance can make me feel better.
Oh my God.
I guess so.
If you just told her straight from the beginning, I'm ashamed, I'm disfigured.
Yeah.
Let's go. I'm pretty sure her response would have been, oh, okay.
Yeah, like, we'll get through this. I'm just glad to have you back.
Super cool.
Thank you for stalking me in a graveyard. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Stalking
means
you care.
Yeah, apparently. That's really the whole message that this movie is trying to make.
I just want to know the alternative Silence of the Lambs world where this movie exists, where Julie rejects him and he starts making Julie skin and prancing around as her. I want to know why that movie hasn't been made.
Let's write into Sam Raimi and ask. Let's figure it out.
He's probably working on it now. It's going to be an anime.
Yeah.
Or he's partnering with Tom Six for that one.
Oh,
Jesus Christ. The Onania, the silence of the Onania. They're all just masturbating in dead silence. I don't know if that would make it better or worse. So Julia, or sorry, Julie keeps, she goes to Strack as a result of all this and says, oh, Strack, you know, I can't see you anymore. We can't be involved with one another. And while she's over there trying to cut it off with him, she discovers that he has the missing memorandum on his desk. And this is where the coffee ring comes into play, because she knows it's the exact copy that she had, or that she had earlier, rather, in the film. Confirming that he was collaborating with Durant the entire time. She reveals Westlake is still alive, but Strack tells her as long as he has the memorandum, no charges can be filed. And somehow in Julie's lawyer brain, that makes sense to her, even though that's not at all the case.
Remotely?
No. But hey, this is Raimi's world. We're just living in it.
And dancing.
Dancing in it, that would have been the better thing to go with. Damn it, missed opportunities. So, yeah, he says that no charges can be filed, which, like I said, is just not true. Julia leaves, and Durant enters and is told to capture Julie and kill Westlake. He proceeds to do just that. Durant intercepts Julie, kidnapping her before attacking Westlake's lair. Two of his men enter the lab to locate and kill Westlake, but are outmaneuvered and eliminated. This is a pretty great scene in and of itself, right? So there's the creative kill where he puts his own face on top of one of the enemy's faces and proceeds to charge them at their own guy.
Which we also see recreated again years later in Mission Impossible 2.
The only thing I really remember about Mission Impossible 2 is that awesome Limp Bizkit song.
Yeah, random little factoid. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh yeah, they did this in this movie too.
Speaking of Limp Bizkit, did you see that link that I sent you about the movie that is no longer called Moose, but I refuse to stop calling Moose?
Yes, I haven't watched it yet.
Okay, God, it was funny. The movie looks genuinely terrible, and I can't wait to watch it. There's a movie being directed by Fred Durst that stars John Travolta.
Shut up. When does it come out?
I think it's already out.
Yeah, it is.
What?
Yeah, it came out.
Is it on Netflix?
No. I think it's doing its like limited theater run right now. Yeah.
I'm here. Let's do it. I'm sold.
It looks pretty awful, but amazing at the same time. So he puts the skin on top of more skin and manages to trick them into shooting each other. That's basically the gist of the scene. Durant flies the helicopter with Westlake dangling from an attached cable, which he uses to crash the helicopter. Impersonating Durant, Westlake meets up with Strack and captures, who is holding a captured Julie, the top of an unfinished building, because all superhero movies need to end on like an unfinished skyscraper hundreds of feet off the ground, because drama
feels right.
Obviously Strack knows that this is not Durant. There's a scene where he asks him how his kids are. Like, aha, gotcha. You don't have any kids. He starts shooting a massive bolt gun in his general direction. And in classic Raimi fashion, we get the camera angle of the bolt flying toward it. And that's just like all over the place in Evil Dead.
Yeah. And somehow, even though he's like 8 feet away from the guy, he misses every single time until the last one where he pins Liam Neeson's hand to the girders.
Yes.
Drama.
There is lots of drama. In what is also probably the most anticlimactic ending to one of these types of films when they're on top of a skyscraper like that. he proceeds to swing at him. Liam Neeson's character, I mean.
Yep.
Proceeds to swing his fist wildly in his general direction. Attempting to stop him from shooting this any further. But Strack reveals that he's been on top of or worked on these since he was like a little kid or something, right?
Yeah.
And as a result, he like misses it. And he loves the surge of adrenaline that comes with it. So he's got a lot more balance and doesn't really bother him. And meanwhile, Liam Neeson's just standing there trying to keep his balance and flopping in the wind. But he ends up being successful. He gets the upper hand and he dangles Strack by the ankle in the air. Strack says that killing him would not do would not be something he could live with, and Westlake drops Drac, remarking, I'm learning to live with a lot of things. Julie tries to convince Westlake that he can still return to his old life, but he tells her he has changed on the inside as well and cannot subject anyone to his new vicious nature. He rushes from Julie as they exit an elevator, pulling on a mask and running into the crowd of pedestrians, cleverly disguised as everyone's favorite deadite killer. As Julie unsuccessfully searches for him, Westlake watches her for a few minutes before turning and walking away, narrating, I am everyone and no one, everywhere, nowhere. Call me Dark Man. It's almost eerily similar to the way that Chris Nolan ended The Dark Knight.
Oh, for sure.
It's like, or sorry, just the Dark Knight. It's like pretty much the exact same fucking ending, just done 20 years earlier. Right? That movie came out like 2010, was it?
Like 2008, wasn't it?
Okay, so 18 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting. I didn't put that together until I rewatched it. Like I said, it's been a long time since I've last seen this film, so. I asked you guys a bunch of questions about this, though.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A lot pertaining to kind of how this is, would be received by a modern audience, how it kind of links into and might have paved the way for modern comic book films. And how, if this were to be rebooted or remade, whether or not it would contain a lot of the Raimi-isms in it these days that it did before. Especially considering how Spider-Man 3 was received.
Oh, God.
So I went a slightly different route with this as far as reboots and remakes.
Yep.
I could see, especially if you're going to keep the Raimi aspects of it, I could see this being turned into like a Monster of the Week episodic series on Netflix or Hulu in the same vein as Ash vs. Evil Dead. On like Hulu or Amazon or Netflix or Shudder or something.
Yeah, I would like to see a little bit more of a serious take on this, personally.
I think it would work as a serious take as well, but I think if you're going to keep the kind of like Raimi feel,
mm-hmm.
especially nowadays, I'm pretty sure that's really the only direction you could go with. I don't think you could do a Raimi-esque version of this movie as a movie.
Would you want to see? Would you want to see Raimi do it again?
I don't know. I'm honestly leaning towards no.
Who else would you see taking the helm of this?
It would never happen.
Martin Scorsese. No, I'm just kidding.
I wouldn't mind seeing his friend, who's got experience taking Raimi's movies and modernizing them. Evil Dead Remake.
Fede Alvarez.
Yes. I wouldn't mind seeing Fede Alvarez taking this and modernizing it. Simply because we've seen him do it with Raimi's stuff before, and it worked, I think, wonderfully.
Would you want them to include the amount of violence that he did, though? Or do you think you could do this as a PG-13 film? Because the big, I guess...
I think if you're going to do it as a PG-13 film, I don't see any reason why you'd have anyone other than Raimi come back and do it. I think if you're going to have somebody who's not Sam Raimi do this movie, it's got to be rated R. And you're going to lose the slapstick elements. If you're going to keep the slapstick stuff, you might as well just let Raimi do it.
What about you, Ash? How do you feel about this?
I have a lot of thoughts. I have a lot of fucking thoughts. I definitely agree with the Monster of the Week element. I think that would especially work for this because Sam Raimi has an inherent very dark comedy tinge to him.
Right.
So if he's directing it, I agree with Sam. It would kind of have to go in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was a film, I might actually want to go a different direction. And I'd want to see, just for my pure curiosity's sake, I'd want to see the Coen brothers.
Oh, that could be interesting.
That could be good.
Just because I read that, first of all, we've already said there's like 1,000 people have had their hands in this pot to write the script.
Right.
They were two of the people who also helped like kind of finish up the loose ends with it. So I'd be interested to see their overall take on it.
I could see that working really well, actually. I have a lot of respect for them.
This movie, and as a, I guess, official or unofficial, I've seen people say it is a superhero movie. I've seen people say it's not. But regardless, this kind of kicked off the 90s era of like screwball superhero movies.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, just in that decade, we have Barbed Wire, we have Tank Girl, which is based on the comics, we have The Mask, we have Blank Man, which is one of my personal favorites.
I fucking forgot Barbed Wire was even a thing.
Yep. We have Judge Dredd.
What a terrible film.
We have Judge Dredd. We have The Phantom. We have some of the weirdest and potentially worst Batman movies ever made.
Nipple Suit Batman.
Nipple Suit Batman. Batman. We have Mystery Men, which is great. And we have what I think might actually be the perfect comp for this movie.
Hmm.
And I know we've talked about this plenty of times before.
Hmm.
Spawn.
Oh, yeah. Well, to an extent. Yeah. You look like you got some thoughts on this.
I like Spawn a lot.
I do too.
I
like that movie a lot, but it's also, if you look at the slapstick in this movie and then you compare it to what happens 7 years later when you have John Leguizamo playing the clown.
Mm.
But that, once again, that makes sense but with like that character.
That makes sense. But remember, this movie was like the precursor to all of these superhero movies over the next 7 to 10 years.
Yeah. That precursor to the comics, precursor to a lot of the, like, you know, Spawn, for instance. And I think it was like 4 years later.
So, like, this movie is rightly or wrongly responsible for what we got in the 90s as far as superhero movies went. And whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not entirely sure. Because most of the movies on this list, I'm not going to go out on a limb and argue and say they're like cinematic masterpieces by any means.
No.
But I love just about every movie on this list.
Except for Nipple Suit Batman. That is Oscar-worthy material.
I love Nipple Suit Batman.
I mean, even RoboCop 2 and 3 came out after this. And those were...
They had good amounts of humor in them. Well, RoboCop itself also had good amounts of humor.
Yeah, but they were wildly different in temperament compared to the first one.
Yes.
And I think this movie had something to do with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think you're right. I mean, like, I think it's responsible for a whole bunch of things. And regardless of, like, whether or not you agree with the direction, that is very much Raimi. You can't argue that it doesn't have his seal on it, you know? Like, you watch this, and regardless of whether or not you know that it's directed by Raimi, if you're familiar with the rest of Raimi's films...
If you've seen Spider-Man 3.
You could probably look at it and be like, I'm willing to bet Sam Raimi directed this.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
Right down to the racist caricatures. Because they are just so over the top in this. That scene where he's talking I guess he's supposed to be like a triad crime lord or whatever. And he,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Accent on that was real rough around the edges. And I'm like, dude, you're a Chinese guy, like, playing this role, and you're okay.
I just watched that, and I felt like the human embodiment of that gif of, oh no, baby, what is you doing?
But again, that was not uncommon for the time.
No, like, not at all. I mean, like, it's,
and if you look at the Brat Pack movies, that shit happened all the fucking time through the 80s and into the early 90s with stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So... definitely not out of place then.
Just no.
Definitely cringeworthy now.
It's something. We got to that scene though. It's just, you know, I looked over at my wife and I was just like, that's a thing. And she was like, yeah, that is very much a thing. And then we just kind of went back to watching it. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that, like, because of the overall film itself, there's a lot that you can overlook and easily forgive, whether it be race caricatures or slapstick scenes that really kind of, in my opinion, took away from everything else that was going on. I think overall, though, we have a pretty solid film here.
Well, because, I mean, part of it is, though, like, we're looking at it at the lens of, like, 30 years later. Like, movies like this are not made anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, I'll make an argument for that. Mm. I feel like they tried to do that, tried with the Deadpool film, like the first one. I can definitely see, like, especially in hindsight, especially as we're talking about the list of superhero films that came after this one.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely kind of, I can see where they tried really hard to, like, kind of push a lot of it into that mold that weird kind of aesthetic that the 90s superhero films had.
Yeah. Right.
That didn't necessarily fit. There's still a lot of that in the Deadpool, like the first Deadpool film.
But it works in that case because Deadpool is wildly self-aware. That's so, like, true. It's making fun of itself by doing it. So I think that's why it works. But outside of that, there aren't very many references for movies that have been done or at least have been well received.
I'm just saying, I'm trying to use that as an example that in today's day and, or, you know, in today's time, a lot of the stuff this movie gets away with, right. And we can kind of like give a wink and a nod to watching it even now.
Yeah.
Just wouldn't fly over. So, you know, it wouldn't be the same type of film if you did reboot it in general.
No, right? You're not going to see Future Site of Domestic Abuse Carnival sponsored by Olay if you make this movie today. Like, you're that's right. Just not happening.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I think it would be a lot more aware. I think if they did do it, they would have to tackle a lot more of the characters in our turmoil. A lot of what, for instance, McFarlane tried to do and probably did too much of with Spawn. Because you read the comics?
Oh, yeah.
Have you read the comics recently?
No.
Okay. There is a lot of like too much, like to the point where like every single issue is starting with the like same bullshit. And I got real, real old, real quick. It overstayed its welcome pretty quickly. The last time I tried, cause I have like the first like three volumes, like super thick editions that they did of the original Image Comics run.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, like, a majority of at the beginning of every issue is just him complaining about missing Wanda and, like, wanting to, like how much pain he's in and how much he hates himself and all this stuff. And it starts off, like, the first, like, 15 panels of every issue are just like that. And I'm just like, we get it. There's evolve your character.
Be sad while you're doing something.
Yes, exactly.
Is he just projecting his inability to remake his movie?
I think it's just McFarlane's inability to really write well in general. he created a great character.
Makes a solid toy.
Makes a great toy. Is a fantastic artist. There's just not a whole lot of substance outside of the fact that he's experiencing inner turmoil and kills his victims violently, except for that Batman versus Spawn series that they did. That show was amazing. It still holds up to this day. It's not at all poorly written. I don't know what you're talking about. And I refuse to acknowledge anybody saying otherwise.
You know what would have been better? If he had done his inner turmoil while getting a lovely sideswept bang emo haircut and dancing in a nice fitting suit down the steps.
Exactly. All right, what are we writing this film out of?
Oof.
Out of oofs. Inappropriate slapstick.
No.
Ramiisms. They took my hands. How many hands did they take from this movie, Sam?
Or fingers broken.
Yeah, how many hands and fingers did they take? No, this is Buffalo Bill's wet dream, wearing other people's skin. That's what we're rating. How many Buffalo Bill wet dreams?
Oh, well, that changes everything.
Still 3.25 for me.
I'm going to say 4.
A 4?
Wow. I'm thinking a solid 4.
Okay, all right. Well, I hate to be the lowest person here, but I'm giving it a 2.75. Enjoyable, but, you know, I just don't think it's as great as I remember it being as a kid. So,
it's not.
But if it had come out now, so many memes.
True.
So many animated GIFs.
True. What does that leave us at? A 3.333333333.
Honestly, that feels right.
It does feel right. I can't dispute that.
But now that you mentioned it, I'm legitimately surprised that I haven't seen or noticed Darkman memes. There have to be some, right?
I feel like if you type Darkman into like any sort
or like
of
GIF.
Yeah, Giphy. Like there's got to be something, right? Let's see what pops up when I do it. here.
So there's like three.
Oh, it's just angry Liam Neeson.
And they all take place at the fucking carnival.
Yeah, they're just angry Liam Neeson.
They all take place at the fucking carnival.
Yeah, ooh. That's what I'm getting to.
Ironically. And
why?
Why? Why?
I'm going to use that now for my triggered memes.
I liked Deadpool the first time I saw it when it was called Dark Man.
Thank you. That's another episode of Terror and Podnito in the books.
How was your wine?
It was good.
Final rating?
Final rating, actually probably like 3.5, so plus 0.25.
Okay.
But still, would buy again, would drink again. As always, you can follow us on all the social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all at Terror and Podito. You can follow us individually too. I'm Palmer at Sermsworth. Ash, where can people follow you?
Instagram is your best place. I'm Hurricane Ash, and Twitter, I just post sad memes.
Did you create that name because of our podcast?
The what?
Hurricane Ash? Is it because you came out and saw us in a hurricane? I've always wanted to ask you that. Okay.
Oh, no, that was...
I was just being conceited and thought that might have been because...
I kind of thought it was, too, because I don't... Like, I remember noticing it after the interview, and I was like,
yeah.
Was it always this way?
In hindsight, it worked, but no, I decided to be cute and edgy, and I regret it ever since.
All right, Hurricane Ash, how often do you post? Can people... Are you open? I can't remember. Are you a private profile?
Hurricane Ash. No, that's public.
Okay.
That's pretty much daily. Twitter is my Bill Hader public shrine.
Okay. You do post a lot of Bill Hader stuff. Sam?
I'm at Sam Heebs on Twitter, and I am on Instagram, but I don't have anything posted on there. But I am officially on Instagram. I did actually sign in on purpose for once. I don't know why. I didn't do anything with it, but I'm there.
All right. Good for you, buddy. One step at a time. You can email us, too, through our address, cast@terrorandpodnito.com. You can check out our website, terrorandpodnito.com, and get prepped, because next week is going to bring another one of these movies. We're going to have another guest next week. We've had him on the podcast before, Zeke Kincaid. We're going to talk about his new book. It'll be a rip-roaring good time.
Yeah.
He'll be virtually joining us over the interwebs, the magic of the scapes. That wraps things up. Thanks for listening.
Many thanks to Ash.
Thanks for being part of the rotating third chair. Thanks. And
take a cat home with you if you'd like.
Hell yeah. Take them all.
We hope this won't be the only time. Hopefully we haven't scared you off.
I will come back whenever you want to have me.
Well, look at that. Look at that. We might just use her from now on.
Oh, hell no.
Later, Alex.
No.
Bye. All right, everybody. Take care. We'll catch you all next week. And as always,
keep it creepy.
There you go, buddy. Thank you.